October 24, 1944. The sun is barely above the horizon over the Philippine Sea, and Commander David McCampbell is already climbing hard in his Hellcat. Below him, through broken cloud, a formation of Japanese aircraft stretches across the sky like a dark migration. 60 aircraft, maybe 65, Zeros and torpedo bombers and dive bombers, all of them pointed at the American fleet at Leyte Gulf. McCampbell gets on the radio, he's calling his squadron. And one by one the responses come back wrong. Too far away, out of position, low on fuel. He's got one wingman. I'm Tail Dragger and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. What happened next is one of the most remarkable single pilot stories in the history of naval aviation. And to understand it, you have to understand the aircraft underneath him. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up, if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand the Hellcat, you have to understand what American naval pilots were facing in the first 18 months of the Pacific War. The Mitsubishi A6M-0 was one of the most capable fighter aircraft in the world when the war began. It climbed fast. It turned inside almost anything the Allies had available. Its combat range was extraordinary by the standards of the time, and the Japanese naval aviators flying it in 1941 were some of the most experienced pilots in the world. Many of them had years of combat behind them already, over China, before Pearl Harbor ever happened. The early months of the Pacific War were bad. The Grumman F-4F Wildcat, the Navy's frontline fighter at Pearl Harbor, was outmatched in a close-turning fight with a Zero. The Brewster Buffalo, which some Allied forces were still flying, was nearly hopeless against a competent Zero pilot. American tactics evolved, largely because a man named Jimmy Thack had figured out that dogfighting a Zero at low speed was a good way to die. His weave, a mutual defense maneuver where two fighters covered each other's tails, kept more pilots alive than the numbers suggested should have. But the weave was a survival tactic. You don't win air superiority from a defensive crouch. The Navy understood this. They needed a new aircraft, not a Wildcat variant. Something that could go out and dominate the Zero in every environment carrier aviation demanded. They turned to Grumman Aircraft Engineering Corporation, out of Bethpage, Long Island. Grumman already had a reputation the Navy trusted. Sailors called it the Iron Works, and there was a reason for that. Grumman built aircraft that absorbed punishment the way a well-made truck absorbs a bad road. When they set out to design what would become the Hellcat, they had an instinct about what the aircraft needed to be. And then, in the summer of 1942, they got help they didn't expect. On June 4, 1942, a Japanese naval aviator named Tadayoshi Koga was flying during the attack on Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands. His Zero took battle damage. He attempted a forced landing on Akatan Island, a place the Japanese had pre-designated as an emergency landing zone. The aircraft nosed over in boggy, marshy terrain. Koga did not survive. The Zero did. American forces found the aircraft weeks later. It was damaged, but largely intact. They got it onto a ship, transported it to the Naval Air Station at North Island in San Diego, repaired it, and flew it. Think about what that meant. For the first time, American engineers could sit in a Zero's cockpit, take every measurement they needed, study the fuel system, the control runs, the wing structure, test pilots flew it against American aircraft in simulated engagements. They found out exactly what the Zero could and couldn't do. The Zero's exceptional low-speed maneuverability came at a cost. Almost no pilot armor, no self-sealing fuel tanks. The ailerons loaded up heavily at high speed. Well above 250 miles per hour, the Zero's roll rate dropped away badly. A Zero pilot above that speed threshold was working against his own aircraft, and structurally it was built for lightness over survivability. One good burst of .50 fire into a Zero's fuel tanks, and the results were usually final. Grumman took that intelligence and built around it. The result was the F-6F Hellcat. They put in the Pratt & Whitney R2-800 Double Wasp. 18 cylinders, 2 rows of 9, 2,000 horsepower. This was the same engine going into the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, and there is a reason both aircraft developed reputations for simply refusing to quit. The Double Wasp was air-cooled and could absorb extraordinary battle damage. Pilots brought Hellcats home with cylinders shattered and oil streaming and pieces of cowling gone, and that engine still turning. It was one of the great power plants in the history of aviation. The Hellcat was not a small aircraft, loaded for combat. It came in at over 12,000 pounds. Wingspan of 42.5 feet. Coming from the Wildcat, some pilots thought it looked too big for a carrier. What they discovered in the air was that all that mass and all that horsepower gave them an energy advantage that changed the nature of every engagement. Grumman armored the cockpit with plate behind the pilot's seat, self-sealing fuel tanks, 6.50 caliber machine guns in the wings, with 800 rounds per gun. They built the airframe to handle dives that would strip wings off lighter aircraft. And that wide wing combined with hydraulic boost on the ailerons gave the Hellcat a roll rate at high speed that a Zero pilot simply could not match. The tactic was straightforward. Keep your speed up, dive through the formation, pull up before the Zeros can respond, climb back to altitude and reset. Use the double Wasp's power to dictate the terms. A Zero pilot who bled his speed trying to turn with a Hellcat was going to find that the Hellcat could outroll him when it mattered. A Zero pilot who tried to follow a diving Hellcat into high-speed maneuvering was going to find his ailerons turning to concrete. The F-6F entered combat service in August of 1943, flying off the new Essex-class carriers that were pouring out of American shipyards. Within a few months, it was clear something had shifted in the Pacific Air War. By June of 1944, that shift had become a rout. The Marianas Campaign, American carriers versus what remained of Japanese carrier aviation. 2 days of fighting. American pilots called it the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, and that name, blunt as it is, captures what happened. Japanese carriers launched aircraft, and most of them did not come back. The balance of power in the Pacific, which had been shifting for a year, finally broke open completely. The Hellcat was the primary reason why. Commander David McCampbell flew through all of it with Fighter Squadron 15, BF-15, aboard the Essex. He was 33 years old when he went into combat, which is old for a fighter pilot. A Naval Academy graduate who had spent time as a carrier landing signal officer before finally getting into fighters. He was methodical, patient, a man who understood the geometry of aerial combat the way a chess player understands tempo. He came out of the Marianas with a growing reputation and a growing kill count. By October of 44, he was one of the Navy's leading aces and in command of VF-15. October 24th, the Battle of Leyte Gulf. The Japanese launched their largest naval operation of the war, a multi-pronged effort to destroy the American landing forces in the Philippines. It was a desperate gamble. Multiple surface groups and air forces, all converging on Leyte in what the Japanese hoped would be the decisive battle that reversed the war's momentum. McCampbell launched from Essex and found himself in the kind of situation that looks like a nightmare until it looks like history. The Japanese formation was inbound. His squadron was scattered by circumstances, some too far out, some low on fuel. When he tallied up who he had available, it was him and his wingman, Lieutenant Roy Rushing. 60 aircraft, maybe more, coming at the fleet. He went in anyway. Now here's where it gets interesting. What McCampbell did for the next 90 minutes was not a charge. It was a clinic. He worked the formation the way you'd expect from a pilot who had studied this problem for years. Pick a target on the edge of the formation, high-speed pass, pull through before the Zeros can turn to engage. Use that double Wasp to climb back to altitude before anyone can follow. Find the next target, reset, go again. For over 90 minutes, McCampbell and Rushing worked that formation. When it was over, McCampbell had scored 9 confirmed aerial victories in a single engagement. Rushing had 6. Between 2 men and 2 Hellcats, they had broken up a strike of more than 60 aircraft and driven the survivors away from the American fleet. McCampbell recovered aboard Essex nearly dry on fuel and almost out of ammunition. He told the debriefers that he wasn't sure he had enough rounds left for one more burst. For that mission, and for a total of 34 confirmed aerial victories, the highest of any American naval aviator in history, a record that stands to this day, Commander David McCampbell received the Medal of Honor. The Hellcat story and McCampbell's story are really one story, because a lesser aircraft doesn't survive 90 minutes over that formation. Japanese naval aviation in late 44 was not what it had been in 41. The elite pilots who struck Pearl Harbor, who fought at Coral Sea and Midway, most of them were gone by then. But the men McCampbell faced that morning weren't amateurs either. The Hellcat took hits during that engagement. What it didn't do was come apart. The armor, the self-sealing tanks, the structural strength. Those weren't lines on a specification sheet. They were reasons David McCampbell came home. When the war ended in August of 45, Hellcats had destroyed over 5,100 enemy aircraft in aerial combat. The kill ratio against Japanese aircraft has been calculated at roughly 19 to 1 over 12,200 F-6. F Hellcats were built in under 3 years. After the war, the French Navy flew them over Indochina. Uruguay kept Hellcats in service well into the 1960s. A number survive airworthy today. The National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida has a superb example. And if you're ever at an air show when one taxis out and the pilot opens that R2800 up to takeoff power, I want you to pay attention to what happens. You'll feel it before you hear it, coming up through the soles of your feet from 40 yards away. That's 2,000 horsepower looking for traction. That's the sound of the aircraft that won the Pacific Air War. The Hellcat doesn't get the mythology the Mustang carries. It doesn't have the romantic story the Spitfire has. But if you want to make the case for which single aircraft most decisively changed the air war in its theater, the F-6F's argument is as strong as any you'll find in aviation history. 19-1 doesn't happen by accident. It happens because a crashed Zero on a remote Alaskan island told Grumman's engineers exactly what to build. It happens because the ironworks lived up to its name. And it happens because men like David McCampbell understood their aircraft well enough to take 90 minutes from the impossible and turn it into history. My sources today include Barrett Tillman's work on the Hellcat, the National Naval Aviation Museum's historical records, and the official Medal of Honor citation for Commander McCampbell, which is worth reading in full. You'll find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. We'll see you next time.